It's just about...
10 years ago, in fact, I think 10 years ago next month, that I attended my first meeting of the Commission on Theology and Church Relations, a kind of an orientation session because my tour of duty did not begin until January of 1974. And at that time, Dr. Bowman, on leave from his duties here at the seminary, was still serving as the executive secretary of the commission. And since that time, it's been my privilege to be associated with him in various aspects of the commission's work and other phases of church work. You know him, of course, not only as the president, but before that as professor here for more than 20 years. And God used him in a wonderful way, particularly during his presidency in working the miracle of the recovery of Concordia Seminary and the dramatic increase in enrollment that has brought us to this day. Since his election as the president, he has given to our church the same kind of progressive leadership that characterized his days here at Concordia Seminary, determined to maintain under God the wonderful heritage that we have as children of the Reformation in our dear church body, and at the same time to provide a leadership that is looking forward, that is reaching out, and that is aggressive in terms of gospel proclamation throughout all the world. We thank God for him, and it is always a great pleasure to introduce to you the president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, Dr. Ralph Bowman.
Thank you, Dr. Barth. You're always so kind when you introduce me that it almost, but not quite, persuades me to be nice to you in return. I've always enjoyed the opportunity to come back to this place, which has such a special place in the hearts of not only me, but my wife and children as well. You can't spend so many years at a place doing something that you love very much and not miss it a great deal, and that's certainly true of Concordia Seminary. I was remarking to Dr. Soufflet over there before, though, that it's amazing how quickly 2 or 3 years go by. I remember when we left with my wife in tears and the kids wondering what was in store for them leaving this place. I assured them, oh, we'll be back for every basketball game, every concert. You know how that goes, and we haven't quite lived up to that. It's good to be back, and I thank all of you for having us back. It's good to see Dr. Barth again. I have the same experience with my friend Carl. We've been so close for so many years. The same experience I think I used to have with Dr. Preuss when he was president of Synod. People out in the church think that we meet together at least 3 or 4 times a week to discuss everything. Actually, Dr. Preuss and I used to see each other more on the road than in St. Louis, and I think that's true to some extent of Carl. He is, without doubt, I'm prejudiced. He's a close friend of mine, but he's also doing an excellent job, I think, in providing leadership to theological education in the Synod and this seminary in particular. I think you can say it without fear of contradiction that in the last 15 years, since 1969, Dr. Barth would rank as one of the top 3 presidents of this seminary. We'll play around with that after a while, see how we rank them, but... well, are you going to have a 10th anniversary celebration on February 20? That's another topic. We'll talk about that sometime. Well, I noticed from the daily announcements that my presence here is described as a discussion of the future of the Missouri Synod. Whoever wrote that's more optimistic than I am. Somebody evidently thinks we have one. And judging from this morning's mail that I was dictating before I ran over, I'm not so sure that all would agree. But I would like to do is to divide the time we have together into 3 parts. with Dick Schultz and other homileticians around, I figured that was mandatory. I'd like to do part one, a kind of a news, some things that are going on in the Synod that you may or may not have heard of, and if you want to push any of those items later on in questions and answers, we'll do that. And then maybe the second part, we could talk about the future or some emphases for the future of the Synod, and then the last part would be questions. And I have until 11:30. If you do too, that's fine. And if you don't, please feel free to get up and leave or whatever you do when you decide you don't have enough time. Some news items. Let me start with some people news. We have had some changes in synodical personnel that I want to mention briefly. Not only do we have some new officers installed in the Synod just a few weeks ago, Dr. Rosine replacing our secretary for 18 years, Dr. Herbert Miller. We have some new vice presidents as well, notably the absence of Dr. Guido Merkins, who was on the seminary's board and was a vice president for a number of years. That absence is very obvious to us in leadership. Dr. George Bordeman, who serves as the president of the English district, has also announced his retirement effective the end of January. If you had not heard that, perhaps you would like to know about it. Dr. Gerhard Hyatt, who has served as the president of Concordia College in St. Paul for some years after serving his nation and his church as chief of chaplains and a distinguished military chaplain, has now come aboard the synodical administration as assistant to the president. His initial duties will be to give executive staff services to the Board for Professional Education Services, the position formerly held by Dr. Rosine. But eventually it is hoped that Dr. Hyatt will provide me with some extra assistance. And of course, we have moved Jim Rice from your midst to ours in the Communications Department of the Synod. We're looking forward to working closely with Jim in that important assignment. Rudolf Block has been installed as associate in the area of higher education. And Jim Shaw has the new desk in military personnel work for the Synod. When we're talking people, though, I suppose no change in personnel is more significant from my standpoint than the death about 1 month ago of a dear friend and colleague, Dr. Joe Lavallee. We buried him on September 21, just a few days after he had turned 70, less than 1 month before he would have observed the 40th anniversary of his pastorate at St. Philip's in Philadelphia. In his funeral, which was attended by Dr. Soflo representing the seminary, it was delightful to hear the many tributes to this man and to hear the many firsts that need to be attributed to him. The first black pastor of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Joe used to tell with his good humor that he was sure that the convention that received him into membership wasn't aware of the fact that he was black. In fact, they thought his name, Lavallee, meant he was French. That was bad enough in a German church, but they didn't really know that he was black. But you couldn't know Joe very long and remember that he was black for very long. Joe was first and foremost a child of God, a pastor of the church, and I think that we're going to miss Joe a great deal. I only wish that you had all gotten to know him as well as I. I did receive a letter yesterday, though, about Joe from one of the pastors of the church, and I'm going to read just a little bit of it because I think it says it pretty well. While there are many who could reflect more intimately on the life of Joseph Lavallee than I did see a connection between this Joseph and the Joseph who was sold into slavery by his brothers. God raised that Joseph to positions of authority and leadership, but he would not forget in his own mind and would not let his brothers forget that he was Joseph, their brother. When one reflects on the life of Joseph Lavallee, one has to see the remarkable faith that this man had that would not let a church body forget that he was Joseph, their brother, even when we as white Lutherans didn't want to hear it, didn't believe it, didn't really care. He hung in there. He loved us. He forgave us. He helped us to understand what true brotherhood really is. To me, very personally, that's the significance of the firsts in Joe's life. To me, it was a church body at long last giving recognition in a tangible way to a people called by God to teach the rest of us true brotherhood. And he goes on to suggest that we mourn his passing by a renewed effort to work among the minorities in our country and in our church. Let me go on to some other items, because I know how little time we have and how many questions you probably have. You have read, I think, in recent weeks of the most recent action involving Grace Congregation in River Forest. Let me mention that one just briefly, because I think it's been in the news for many of you for a long, long time. This is the congregation that has the beautiful church on the corner of the campus of our River Forest College. And there's a very unique contractual arrangement that was entered into in 1929 between that congregation and the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. During the upheavals of the 70s, the pastor of that congregation, Dean Luking, and his members were disenchanted with the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. One thing led to another, and the congregation decided to go its own way, at which point the Synod reminded everyone of the legal contract from 1929. It could not be resolved amicably. Finally, the Synod was sued. I underscore that. The Synod was sued. Passive voice. We did not initiate litigation. But in order to protect that contract and the people of the church who were involved in it in the 1920s, we have been involved in litigation over the disposal of that situation. And most recently, the appeals court announced its decision, which is a kind of no-win, no-lose decision for both parties in the litigation. The contract is declared valid, but its enforceability under the present circumstances, and that needs to be underscored too, under the present circumstances, was declared to be nil. The board of directors, in its meeting just a week and a half ago, has decided not to pursue further legal options available to us at this time, and has instead instructed me, President Hoppel of the Northern Illinois District, and Dr. Krentz, the new president of River Forest, to pursue an amicable settlement, if at all possible, with the congregation. So it will be a pastor-to-pastor kind of discussion, we hope, with the folks at Grace River Forest, and we hope and pray that something good will come out of that as well. Luther Jubilee events are getting into high gear these days. In fact, your announcement, Carl, about tomorrow night's concert is certainly a sign in the St. Louis area, and I think well beyond it, of the celebrations that are beginning all over the country. I surely want to commend Concordia Seminary, to Dr. Barth and Dr. Fremder, and the many others who conceived the idea of the concert at Powell Hall. It's being mentioned all over the world, literally, as one of the world highlights in the commemoration of Dr. Luther, kind of a unique approach to it. We Lutherans aren't gathering just to make a bunch of speeches and preach some sermons, but to listen to a world-class symphony remind us of the priceless legacy that is ours from Dr. Luther as musician and theologian. But a lot of things are happening all over the Synod and indeed beyond it. Everywhere I'm going, it's kind of delightful to find congregations and circuits and districts gathering for rallies of one kind or another to commemorate Dr. Luther. The big week, in many respects, is November 6 to 12, when in Washington, D.C., there will be a pan-Lutheran commemoration of Luther featuring all kinds of interesting things. It gets underway on Sunday the 6th with a pageant in the Church of the Immaculate Conception, Roman Catholic, in Washington, D.C. But please note that it's a pageant a play of sorts. I've seen some quotes from the dialogue, and I'm not particularly pleased with it, but that's predictable too. Let me just a little footnote. I don't know why it is in this commemoration year so many Lutherans feel compelled to highlight Luther's sins, faults, and failures. Most of the time, when somebody has a birthday, or even folks like us who aren't anywhere near 500, Dr. Barth may be, but you know, you try to say something nice about the guy. But in Luther's case, we Lutherans seem to be bending over backwards to describe Luther's wretched statements about the Jews in the last years of his life, or something else. And unfortunately, the pageant script for Washington does call attention to his vulgarity, his coarseness, and that kind of thing. But we hope that we can get something in it that will also point to his, not inconsiderable, religious contributions as well. The week, though, brings together scholars from various parts of the world, a lot of name theologians delivering papers. There are concerts at the Kennedy Center, exhibitions of Reformation-related art at the National Gallery in Washington, a play, and then on November 10th, a big birthday party with Roland Bainton and the possibility of some White House participation. On November 11th, the Postal Department will be officially issuing the commemorative stamp on Dr. Luther, unless the ACLU is successful in blocking that at the last moment. But it promises to be a pretty good week, and I think that we in the Missouri Synod can rightfully feel proud of that week as well. I hope that the seminary will do other things, though, that are perhaps less splashy but more appropriate to commemorating Dr. Luther. For one thing, I hope you do something on November 11, which is the 500th anniversary of his baptism. It seems to me a more significant date in many respects than the 10th, although we'll also be doing things on that day. There wouldn't have been a baptism, I guess, if there hadn't been a birth, right, Carl? I still remember my logic from... But there are so many, many things that need doing, and I am sure you are planning to do them and are doing them in class and the like, to, by way of research, by way of conferences and so on, to highlight your own understanding and appreciation of Dr. Luther. I can think of no better suggestion than personal reading programs. It's been an embarrassment to me as a prof and a president of a seminary how little Luther there is, of necessity at least, in our curriculum. How many people graduate from the seminary without having read very much Luther? Maybe the small catechism. If we're faithful in Jerry Eichmann's assignments, maybe most of the large catechism gets read. And so on. We do a little better than that, obviously, but a lot more would be desirable. There is a peculiar openness to Luther at this point, ecumenically and even outside of the Christian church. Just look what's happening in Germany. The big world bash, Luther's birthday, is in East Germany. They're also celebrating Karl Marx's anniversary this year in East Germany, and the posters are side by side, I'm told. And there's no doubt about it that they're trying to commemorate Luther as the great folk hero, the great progenitor of the revolutions that were to come later on. But a peculiar openness to this man at this time, and a good time for us to, I think, speak of him with some fondness and familiarity. Speaking of Luther, justification is a topic on my list of things going on. Within the Missouri Synod, we point to the theses on justification put out by the Commission on Theology and Church Relations. It seems to me that they are getting a lot of attention, a lot of study in pastors' conferences and beyond throughout the Synod. I hope that you too, as students and profs, will either use the theses or something like them to review and underscore and reinforce the centrality of this great teaching, both for our personal faith and our theology, but perhaps equally strongly for the preaching that goes on in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. There is a great need of it. It's very easy for us to point to inadequacies in the statements of others, but I dare say that the greatest inadequacy in the Missouri Synod appreciation of justification probably could be exemplified best in the preaching of the Synod, which does not articulate as clearly and strongly and persuasively this great cantus firmus, this great song, this great theme of the New Testament, and indeed of all of the Christian faith. The Dr. Walter A. Meyer matter is closely related to that. I know there is continuing interest in what's happening there. Let me say briefly that Dr. Meyer's case involving his essays on justification is primarily in the hands of his seminary president, Dr. Robert Preuss, and the Board of Regents of the Fort Wayne Seminary. I was rather directly involved in the year and a half after I was elected president of Synod, and met with him on a number of occasions, but I felt last spring that it was best if his case were pursued more vigorously by his seminary supervisors than by me. However, I have met with him since the convention, and indeed all of the vice presidents together with me met with Dr. Meyer just a few weeks ago. We continue to hope and pray and plead with him to make it clear to the Synod that he does, in fact, accept our position on justification. I am not very optimistic of a peaceful solution to that case. I regret to say that, because I think that circumstances have caused Dr. Meyer to dig in his heels on his position, and it has caused many others to suggest that he is teaching far different things, more problematic than he really is. So it's very difficult, I think, to keep his position in balance and to bring about a peaceful solution. We hope and pray, and if you want more questions on that one, please feel free to ask me. I'll probably refer him to Dr. Barth. Carl, I'm sure glad you came today. In the area of justification right now, however, the focus is not on Meyer and not on the CTCR theses. It's on the Roman Catholic Lutheran statement. I just got my copy yesterday. I don't know, Carl, did Sam send it to every... Probably coming in a day or so. The initial text, I think, is put out by a Roman Catholic publisher in... What is that thing called? It starts with a C. Currents or something like that. And perhaps Mr. Keenoff is here. The bookstore could probably get copies of that fairly soon, I should think. Let me comment briefly on that, because there have been some telephone conversations. I had a report yesterday in the mail from the Missouri Synod representative on that dialogue, and Dr. Nafsker and I talked about it just this morning briefly. Let me tell you just a little bit about it so that you can answer questions if people ask you. One question is, was the Missouri Synod involved in that process and in that statement? And the answer is yes. The Missouri Synod has been not an observer, an actual participant in the Catholic Lutheran dialogues ever since their beginning in 1965. The dialogues nationally are sponsored by what is called Lutheran World Ministries. Not LACUSA, Lutheran World Ministries. That's the USA arm of the Lutheran World Federation, and it's that group that sponsors this particular dialogue. From the very beginning, they have always invited the Missouri Synod to send participants, and we have done so. For many years, our two representatives were Dr. Arthur Carl Peepcorn and Dr. Fred Kramer of our Springfield Seminary. Fred didn't move to Fort Wayne because of his age. Fred has been a constant participant in the dialogues that go back to 65 until his retirement from that process about a year ago. So Fred Kramer was not involved in the final draft. And Dr. Peepcorn's initial replacement was yours truly for a couple of years. And then when I couldn't make the meetings any longer, John Johnson, not the real John Johnson from this seminary, but the one who masquerades as John Johnson in Florida. You know, speaking of John Johnson in this seminary, I don't know if he's here or not. You know, he dared to give an exegetical paper at a pastor's conference recently. Who ever heard of a systematician being able to read the New Testament? He pulled it off very well. Where are you, John? Are you here? I can say that to John because I was once a systematician too. At any rate, John Johnson, parish pastor in Florida these days, once upon a time, I think, was assistant academic dean at Springfield, was involved and apparently did go along with the document that was agreed upon. It was not signed, it was agreed upon. Well, what's the significance of it? Let's just assume the best for a minute. Assume that this 23,000-word document is completely echt. You know, as if Dr. Martin had written it himself, or St. Paul, or someone like that. I think one of the realistic appraisals would have to be that it represents approximately 21 theologians, that the Catholic theologians, while they are the first team of theology for American Roman Catholics, really don't speak for the Roman Catholic Church, nor do the Lutherans speak for the Lutheran churches, for that matter. They are there as individual, responsible, but individual theologians. Even, as I say, even if every word in that agreement were perfect from a biblical point of view, the question of whether it really represents the millions of Roman Catholics and Lutherans all over the world would need to be addressed before you can jump to some of the conclusions that the Globe Democrat did locally Sunday when it said the 462-year problem was now at an end. I think that's a little bit optimistic. We need to remember, I think, another point on that, and that's that the document is very, very highly nuanced. When you see it, you'll see that it is written by theologians for theologians, pretty much. It has all kinds of the adjectives and adverbs that give to many statements what one philosopher called the death of a thousand qualifications. That ultimately there are no church-divisive theological problems between Catholics and Lutherans in this area. Well, pay attention to the ultimately. Sam Nafsker just talked to Joe Burgess, who's our Lutheran Council Executive in Theology, the other day, and he said, yes, I could vote for that, Sam, because of the word ultimately. For me, that means eschatologically in heaven. There would be no problems. You have that kind of nuancing is the in word for that sort of thing. And you get others who will say, we did not adopt a consensus statement. This is a statement of convergence. And so a nuance must be understood. The dialogue people felt they were expressing convergences, not consensus. Keeping all those things in mind, let me sound a little bit more upbeat. I think it's delightful, however, that Catholics and Lutherans are affirming the grace of God in Jesus Christ and recognizing in this very, very public way that man's only hope is in the mercy of God in Jesus Christ. I think that does come through, and I do think we should praise God for every advance, however small, along the way that has been made and will continue to be made between Lutherans and Roman Catholics. It's almost ludicrous, however, to read some of these reports that say, in effect, the Catholics finally acknowledge that God's grace is responsible for our salvation, and the Lutherans have finally come to realize that good works are also important in the overall dimensions of the Christian life. As though Lutherans have now discovered good works and Catholics have discovered the grace of God, really now, I think the Reformation began had some other point. And I don't think that that's a particularly, insightful analysis of what went on. Well, let's capitalize on it. I think the discussion of justification is not going to be on Walter A. Meyer and his position in terms of the worldwide Christian community. It's going to be on issues raised by Catholics and Lutherans. Let me have a couple other newsy items here, and then I better get on with it, or I won't be leaving enough time for you to ask questions. Synod's governmental relations. That's a whole big area. Let me just highlight a couple of things that have been in the news. A young medical doctor by the name of Dr. Ibarra has been in prison, as I think many of you know, in El Salvador for several months. Dr. Ibarra, together with Pastor Gomez, both of whom are affiliated with the Missouri Synod's work in El Salvador, were seized and placed into prison on the same road from the airport to San Salvador where some Catholic sisters lost their lives some years ago. And without going into a lot of ancient history, it just happened that I was in Washington the day that happened and got the phone call, and I had an appointment with Mr. Meese the next day and was able to ask him whether the White House could push some buttons, and he said, sure, we can try. And the next day he called back and said that the pastor had been released. So the pastor was out of jail within, 2 days or something of his incarceration. But the doctor who ran the refugee camp, the medical part of the refugee camp that Lutheran World Relief operates in Salvador, has been linked with the guerrillas in terms of medical relief and remains in jail. We have tried all kinds of things to get him out, including a mission that hasn't been advertised to Salvador by Congressman Dannemeyer of California, member of the Missouri Synod, who met with Ibarra, who met with President Zagana of Salvador, and we have met with Meese a couple of times, State Department people. The Lutheran World Relief people are involved in it. There are some indications that they may be weakening and that he may be on his way out. I urge you to continue to remember him in your prayers. More recently, and on a slightly different topic, but still government relations, you may have read a statement coming out of the Lutheran Council's Office for Governmental Affairs criticizing the Reagan administration for its Central American policies, but in general just plain criticizing the Reagan administration for not meeting with mainline denominational leaders and for not showing an interest in the concerns for human rights that characterize mainline denominations. When you read a statement like that in the newspapers or in Lutheran papers emanating from the so-called Office of Governmental Affairs, OGA, of the Lutheran Council, please know that the Missouri Synod does not involve itself in that office. We are going to some lengths to make that known in Washington. The White House knows it, State Department knows it, a few other places. But we do not participate financially or in any other way in that office. And in terms of this particular statement, I have given the White House a letter stating that we disassociate ourselves from it, and we have asked the Lutheran Council officials to consider whether there's anything we can do to keep Mr. Bergstrom from making such statements in the future. Lest you think that I'm advocating a different political slant in church statements on Mr. Reagan's administration, I am not. I don't think it's the business of the Lutheran churches to be praising Mr. Reagan or condemning Mr. Reagan. It seems to me our job is a different one, and it is not being carried out very well by the Lutheran Council office in Washington. Church relations, big topic. Let me just hint at a couple of things that are happening there. The Vancouver Assembly of the World Council of Churches concluded recently, and I'm sure you've read your own evaluations of that. We did not involve ourselves in it as a synod. Really, we weren't invited to, but even if we had been, we probably would not have gone. Although I think it needs to be said that many more or less conservative evangelical people there feel that this assembly had some more theological, more evangelism of centered activities than some previous assemblies. We'll have to continue to monitor our role, our relationship with the World Council because of its significance in the world. A little closer to home, we have had a Missouri Synod meeting with the heads of the American Lutheran Church in September. Relationships there continue to be very cordial, but I do believe that we will be moving from bilateral conversations with the American Lutheran Church to conversations with all Lutheran churches involved in the formation of the new Lutheran Church. And that commission, the so-called CNLC, Commission for a New Lutheran Church, also met in September. The Missouri Synod was invited to send and did send an observer to that meeting. That was Dr. Sam Nafsker. If you have time in your schedules for an interesting convocation sometime, I think it'd be kind of neat to have Sam out and talk about the shape of that new Lutheran church. Sam has brought back all kinds of documents and a very careful and detailed report on the meeting to form a new Lutheran church. And again, if you have questions about that, I'd be happy to try to answer them. They appear to be pretty much on schedule at this point, but the key meeting will be in February when a theological statement and a number of other statements about the size and shape and direction of that new church will be up for adoption. The theological statement, which I think some of us have seen, omits any direct statement that the scriptures are the word of God without qualification. Very carefully nuanced statement, which most readers, I think, will find to be a very conservative and traditional statement of biblical authority, but which nevertheless does not really say very much about the scriptures, even which you could do, I think, even without the word inerrancy, a word that is not used in that statement either. It's going to be very difficult, I think, for that new church to stay on schedule. The schedule calls for them to have the new church in place by January 1, 1988. They're either going to have to give up much of the process that they had hoped to follow in getting the approval and participation of their grassroots. They're either going to have to give that up or prolong the time. There are just too many big questions, I think, for them to address. Questions like the name of the church. Do you have one headquarters or several? Even lots harder questions. Where does the money go? Does the congregation own its property or is it owned by the church body? They do it differently now. Will the benevolences or the monies given for work outside the congregation be sent to the headquarters first or after the regional activities of the church are paid for? And they do that differently now. The question of the role of the bishop, as they call their district presidents, or an even more interesting question maybe, will there be really one large church body with a strong central administration, or will there be a regional church body with maybe 8 or 10 regions given their own archbishop or whatever they would call him, held together by some rather loose national framework? That's a very popular suggestion in the other church. And I know that we're all interested in this in the Missouri Synod because we will have to relate to the new church in many ways. Relationships at the present time between the leadership of that new church and the Missouri Synod remain very cordial, very frank and open. Nothing is being held back from us nor from us to them, and I feel reasonably good about that. We've been streamlining the Lutheran Council lately, but that perhaps doesn't involve you so directly, so I won't say much about that. A statement came out this week on the results of the Lutheran Reformed dialogues nationally that make the Catholic Lutheran Agreement, as well as the previously enacted interim Eucharistic sharing between Lutherans and Episcopalians, it makes them seem rather pale by comparison. The Reformed and the Lutheran theologians, with the Missouri Synod team filing a minority report, predictably. One of these days they're going to ask us to start writing them before they finalize the majority report so that they know what to put in the majority report. But you will read that in the news releases, but the theologians at that dialogue are basically asking for intercommunion between the Reformed churches and the Lutheran churches who participated. And that one, too, you should look at and understand. I think it has some significance. Well, within the Synod, lots of good things continue to happen. The colleges and seminaries, with only one or two exceptions, report good enrollments. We've dedicated the new campus at Concordia, Wisconsin, with a tremendous crowd of people present. Spirits are very high there. A week ago Sunday, we installed Charles Schlimpert as the new president at Concordia in Portland, where, again, they're feeling very good about their enrollment and about the future of that institution. Christ College, Irvine, very good news there. River Forest, Ann Arbor, St. Paul, Minnesota. Many, many good things happening in our colleges and seminaries. And the new President's Commission on Higher Education, which was convened just last week, has also taken note of the good things going on as they study the future of the system. The youth gathering has been pretty well reported, I think, in the papers of the Synod, so I won't say much about that, except that it was sure a lot of fun to be there, and I imagine some of you were there to preach, as I had the chance to do, to the closing service of about 10,000 young people. Was quite a thrill for me personally. I will always remember, I think more than anything else in that service, the gradual. And I must admit that throughout my life, I've never been notably impressed by graduals. Although I enjoy them, I should say that with all you theologians around here. But the gradual there was led by a person listed on the program as the cheerleader, and that was a new one for me too. Reverend Terry Dittmer, cheerleader. Ralph Bowman, preacher, you know, that was pretty traditional, but cheerleader. So when it came time for the gradual, Terry went to the mic and divided the 10,000 people into three groups, gave each one a word, you know, celebration, adoration, exaltation. And when he'd hold up this arm, that group would stand and say celebration, and this group would stand and say exaltation, that one, adoration, then all together praise the Lord. And the cheerleader, as the liturgist for that portion called himself, was at the altar reading, I think, seven or eight different stanzas in praise of God, and having these kids, you know, bounce up and yell. By the time we did that, the eighth stanza, and the gradual was concluded, you know, they just cheered, the natural and spontaneous reaction. I have never heard or felt, you might say, the gospel introduced with the gradual in quite that way. And I don't think page 5 or 168 or whatever it is will ever be quite the same now that the kids are back home. By the way, NBC TV did a one-half-hour filming down at San Antonio, hosted largely by Jean Garten, and she interviews kids and a bunch of others, me, Bimler, others, and they show some scenes from the convention. This is going to be a nationally aired NBC TV show scheduled in many cities for October 16, just Sunday, although many will have their own dates. We're really pleased with it. It's called What a Friend, a takeoff on the Amigos de Cristo theme of the youth gathering. It does not highlight the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. It's just that the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is the whole program. And the theme is really kids and the friendship they have found in Jesus Christ and in each other, and their desire to be a part of the activities of congregations of the church. So a very nice spin-off on that very good event. In many respects, the young people of the Synod have an excellent organization these days. I think it's as strong in some respects as the old Walther League used to be. We're up to 3,600 chapters of LYF, and things look good in some respects in that area. Well, I was going to be brief, and I never do that. I was going to have a part two and then a part three. With part three was going to be questions. I'll give myself 5 minutes for part two, which is on the future of the Church of Missouri Synod. It's often the way it is in life, though, isn't it? You dwell in the past so you can escape the present and avoid the future. But I got a lot of hopes and dreams for the future, seriously. And what I was going to do, I had a little article in the October issue of the Lutheran Witness called Emphases for the Future. And I was going to pick out these these areas where I'm doing some dreaming and do some with you. Let me at least read the headings, and maybe we can infer something of the dreams. One was pastoral growth. I think the pastors of our church are hurting. Hurting in many ways. The pressures of the parish ministry are very strong. They don't feel supported many times by their people. They don't feel that the synodical leadership and structure helps them as much as we could. We need a strong accent on upgrading the attitudes, the knowledge, the sense of self-worth of our pastors. And we're working pretty hard at that in the administration. It's a bigger thing than continuing education, but it embraces it. It's bigger than professional growth, but it embraces that. It's bigger than health, but it certainly includes that. We have far too many pastors in the Synod who are falling victims of alcohol and stress-related illness every week. The phone in our ministerial health office brings us stories of moral problems that require psychiatric help. We simply must get a hold of the pastoral growth dimension of our life in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Our church body has not done much in a formal way to support and upgrade and embrace the task of the parish pastor. It seems to me that's something the faculty and others in the church, together with me, need to address, and address very soon, and develop some plans. Another word on my page is global emphasis. We're inclined to see only where we are. Some students, like their profs, many times act, and I speak here in a very first-person way, we act as though the seminary is the focus of the church, and it really is for us. It's where we work, it's where God has called us to be, and it's very important that we give it that kind of seriousness. But the same problem exists in congregations. People think that the local parish is the end of it all, almost. We in Synod's headquarters act as though the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's structure is the end of all things. Some wish it were, but we are not really seeing the broad church dimensions of our life together as well as we could. And literally, around this world, there are many, many Christian people who are looking to the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and its people for leadership. Leadership in confessional theology, and leadership in that beautiful blend of sound doctrine and missionary zeal and pastoral love and care for human beings that has traditionally been the earmark of the Missouri Synod. So global emphases. I'm going to try to do everything I can for a stronger International Lutheran Conference. That's a group of 25 partner churches of the Missouri Synod that's been meeting kind of quietly for 20 years. Well, we were really blessed here a few weeks ago when a man I talked to announced that he was giving $150,000 to help to that end. And we really hope to deepen the bond between Missouri and other confessional churches worldwide. A third area on my list of things is the service of women. My, would I like to come talk to you on that. Of all the issues that seem to be tearing at our seams in parts of the Missouri Synod, it's this one today. I think every week I answer a minimum of 6 letters from pastors and or congregations who are literally fighting it out on the issue of whether women should be permitted to vote in voters' assemblies. I hear stories, and I say this not because because I'm talking to young pastors, but stories of young pastors leading the charge against the Synod's position on woman suffrage. Not only that the voting is the issue, but apparently there's a fair amount of pastoral counseling going on that, where the pastor sits Fred and Susie down in front of him and they talk about their marriage that's on the rocks, and the pastor's advice is to Susan, submit, obey. That's what God tells you to do, and whether you like it or not, he's the boss, so listen to what he says and do it. And you've got that kind of approach to male-female relationships in the church as well. At any rate, there are pastors' conferences these days discussing whether or not it's a violation of the Word of God to have a woman on the board of directors of Synod. We have a woman's issue smoldering below the surface just a little ways in the Missouri Synod. I don't believe the women of our Synod are asking for ordination. At least I don't meet very many who are or read of very many who are. It's not that. They simply want to be doing what God allows them to do in the church. They want to serve. They want to bear witness. They want to be involved. And I believe we're going to have to work at that. I think one unfortunate kind of action in this church is about all we need to change a lot of these women, particularly younger women. I have one in my household who's 20 years old. Some of you, she drives a tractor here in the... That's that kid who put the hard hat on Luther 3 years ago. I still remember, still hear. Like most girls her age right now, she's, I think, interested in relationships and getting through college, probably in that order, and doesn't particularly want to be ordained. But I think about all it would take for Lynn to get annoyed would be for somebody to tell her that she couldn't vote if she wanted to, or couldn't be on a committee if she wanted to, and she would become somewhat indignant about it, I think, to put it mildly. I believe there are a lot of people, not only at that age, but another 20 years older or so, who feel much the same way. At any rate, the woman's issue needs study. Our own position on voting, I guess, needs study too. I thought we had restudied it 3 or 4 times, but apparently we're not helping very many people with it. By the way, I would like for a non-theological analysis of the concept of suffrage to be done sometime. I think a lot of our problem is people don't understand what it means to cast a vote in a parliamentary assembly. You know, the purpose of casting ballots is to allow the majority to rule and exercise authority. A vote is an instrumentality. It is not in and of itself, in my judgment, an exercise of authority. It's a service to the assembly of which you're a member to allow it to reach a majority decision. Just read Robert's Rules of Order or something like that on it. And when a decision is made, it's the decision of a majority over a minority that has been made in that assembly, and it is the majority that exercises authority, not the sexes involved in establishing that majority. I don't know. I think we simply need to look at the question of voting in and of itself sometime. If you have any questions about matter of woman suffrage, fine. Let's talk about them. I had a couple other things here. Pro-life action. With the word action in caps, we have probably the strongest pro-life position of any Protestant church body in the United States, maybe stronger than Rome's. But it's mostly talk, mostly rhetoric. Haven't done a great deal about it. We're hoping to do something about it in terms of providing educational programs, alternatives, highlighting adoption options and so on. And to that end, letters have gone out to all the hospitals, social agencies, boards, commissions, districts, colleges, and seminaries asking for an analysis of what we're doing. There are other things on the list, Mr. President, but I shall keep at least a portion of my promise and allow some time for questions. It's a pleasure to be with you, and thanks for letting me tease you a little bit.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Dr. Bowman. Might be simpler for you simply to handle the questions. How would that be? So someone open it up.
Okay. Now, who's got... There we go.
I've been hearing on the news that another hospital wants to buy the Lutheran Medical Center. Is that something that the board of control can decide, or is this something which has to go to convention? And
Neither. It's neither of those. It's a complicated arrangement with Lutheran Hospital of St. Louis. It is owned by an association, and the association is made up of local congregations. I think 57 or 58 local congregations form a hospital association. In order to sell that property, it requires a vote of the governing board of that association and a referendum of the congregations who make up the membership, and it takes a two-thirds vote. When this vote to sell came up last time, a majority, the board voted to sell, and a majority of congregations, what was it? Do you remember the vote was, Carl? It failed by 8 votes. Anybody remember? Yeah, something like that. It had a majority, but they didn't have two-thirds. So 8 congregations tipped the scale that time. And this present offer, I only know what I read in the papers, but apparently Election Brothers, this Catholic organization that runs hospitals, it's a not-for-profit organization, has made an offer as recently as Monday, it's the same group, for an additional $7 million, and a for-profit corporation has not yet announced what it's offering, but there are apparently 2 bidders now for Lutheran Hospital, and I suppose the board would meet first, decide what it wants to do, and then refer, if it's positive, refer it to the congregations for a vote. Synod itself does not have any real control over the hospital. Yes?
In the reporter last month, it talked about Senate staying within the budget and the deficit spending for the year. Does that mean that there is some light on the end of the tunnel for Senate and its finances?
I don't know. I hope so. But one of the things you read, I suppose, on the money is that for the first time in 6 years, the last fiscal year ended with a balanced budget in the national operations of the Senate. First time in 6 years. And I don't know, I for one don't feel good about it except in terms of the management of the Senate. It's a management achievement, but it's not a mission accomplishment because we achieved a balanced budget, well, in 3 ways. We lopped $1.9 million out of the budget. That means we didn't do what we should be doing as a church, and the budget we lopped it out of had already had $4 million pared out of it when it was adopted. So that's the major way it got done. There were 2 other factors. 17 of our 38 districts gave more money than they had pledged to give for the national operation, and I was really cheered on by that because districts are hurting too. And the other was a special offering in a number of congregations that yielded $750,000, and with that threefold combination, we were able to balance the budget. Is there light at the end of the tunnel is the key question. And the financial picture in the Senate is a fairly complicated one, and I don't know how much time to take with you. I'd be happy to, as long as you have time. But Synod and Convention, to mention just 2 things, decided to do an intensive stewardship effort in all the congregations of the Synod. And some districts have already been involved in pilot projects of this kind with very, very fine results. The Texas district, for example, recently announced its intention to contribute an additional $500,000 next year to the national budget. The second thing they agreed to do was to sponsor an intensive appeal for funds in not earlier than 1986, a kind of a forward in remembrance effort, with a large amount of that offering expected to go for colleges and seminaries. But that's still in the talking stage. We did, at the board of directors meeting a week and a half ago, engage the same firm, Community Counseling Services of New York, to do a feasibility study of the entire Synod on that drive. There are good signs. I think we are making progress financially, but it's still very, very inadequate. And your own school, which is hurting so badly financially, doesn't, as far as I can see, I can't see any immediate relief for that situation. But I think there's some light at the end of the tunnel, particularly if you build the tunnel long enough. Yes?
There's a rising call from certain quarters for a purge in Synod.
Is that right?
Especially concerning those who are holding dual membership in Missouri and other Lutheran church bodies. Question is twofold. One, what is being done to exercise church discipline where it's needed? And two, how desirable or practical is such a purge or, you know, wide scale, you know, practice.
Okay. So, some comments on the urge to purge. Huh? Okay. Dual memberships, the euphemism given to the situation involving pastors, teachers, congregations who are officially members of the Missouri Synod and officially members of another church body. It's a problem that grew out of the controversy of the 70s. And the Synod has made it quite clear in a number of convention actions that it does not want dual memberships to continue. The last action was taken in 1981, and it said that all such memberships should come to an end by January 1, 1982, unless the district president, with the concurrence of the synodical president, granted an extension. Okay, so in the back in 81, we contacted. The first thing to do was to make a list of all these dual members. And I didn't bring those statistics with me, but that was done very carefully. A file was developed on each situation. It was put in the responsibility was given to Dr. Sauer, the first vice president, to monitor this. We worked with the district presidents. And to make a long story short, we have brought that situation to some extensions were granted for pastoral reasons. We've brought that situation pretty much to a close. Off the top of my head, my recollection is that as of today, there are three congregations in the Missouri Synod holding dual membership with the Association of Evangelical Lutheran Churches. One is in Washington, D.C., and two are in the Atlantic District. And the reasons are in each case different. They are pastoral reasons. They are places where, for example, the one in Washington, which is, some of you have been in the Capitol, it's the only Lutheran church the Missouri Synod has in D.C. itself, and it's very close to the Capitol. This congregation, during the controversy, enacted a clause in its constitution that it takes a two-thirds majority to change its dual membership from that to a single membership, unless one of the two churches kicks the church out. And neither side in that congregation has a two-thirds vote. The pastor, interestingly, has just left. His name is Preisinger. He just took a call to teach in an African theological institution for 3 years, and now guess who they asked to serve as the vacancy pastor? The Missouri Synod district president. My guess is that they will call a Missouri Synod pastor and that the congregation within a year will be only Missouri Synod. We have tried to take each situation, to make a long story short, in terms of its own situation. There are perhaps, in terms of other dual members, there are no more teachers, as I recall. There are about 25 retired pastors, as far as we can tell, who are among this long list of dual memberships, many of them very, very old. And they're dual members probably in order to keep their pension. The net effect of removing them from our membership role at this time would be to give some veterans of the cross who probably made a bad mistake in becoming dual members. Nevertheless, it would be to take away their livelihood. And I've given that a very low priority on my list of things to do. The one stipulation there has been that if any of these retired men go out and stir up trouble against the position of the Missouri Synod, they will be informed that that they will be removed if they don't cut it out. We haven't had to do that. The pastors involved, I think, we're down to 9, and that's just about ready to be eliminated entirely. The larger question is, are we doing anything about discipline? Yes, we're doing a lot about discipline. If there's anything that really bothers a person in a supervisory role, I speak not only now for myself, but for a man like Carl Barth, a man who was a district president, now is president of a large community like this, is that when people assume that you're not exercising Christian discipline. Why do people assume that? Why do they write about that? anybody in the position of being a pastor of a congregation who's giving discipline to his members, president of a seminary, or of a district, of a church body, you don't put it in the newspaper. How many times do you go to church on Sunday and you see the Sunday bulletin? Does the pastor put in there, "This week I dealt in a discipline case with Mr. John Doe, who is suspected of adultery, somebody else for drunkenness," and that kind. You don't do it. I hope you don't. Otherwise, I think you probably won't be there very long. I mean, we just don't do it. So we have some cases that are, they have a lot of notoriety involved. A man like Paul Brecher, to mention a name, and I do so because it's public, not because, if it weren't for that, I wouldn't mention it. My sense of what's correct pastorally and professionally says you don't talk about cases that you're dealing with publicly when you're dealing with them privately. But yes, they are being dealt with. The district presidents are very, very good about this. We have files showing the things that are going on. Paul Brecher is being worked with very, very diligently by Dr. Zimmerman. I don't know of a single case of a reported incident of bad teaching or unionism or anything like that that is not being dealt with. But personally, privately, professionally, spiritually, and we are not about to put it in the papers just because some people like to call for resignations for people who don't do their jobs. I don't think it's very fair. Yes, is that Steve? Good looking beard, Steve.
Can you estimate how long will be before our modern-day school teachers are able to claim the tax break? What does that process entail?
The tax break you're referring to is now which one? The housing allowance?
Yes.
I'm not entirely sure, and I hesitate to speak lest I be quoted in the wrong places for having said something that's being handled by attorneys. And the reason that it's complicated is because that ruling of IRS that has given clergymen, ministers of the gospel, a double tax break on on housing. If you're buying a home, you can claim the amount you're putting out for the house as well as the interest that you're paying on your mortgage. You actually claim that figure twice on your tax returns. That is the law of the land, and it has been legal for a long, long time. That is coming to an end. The original ruling ended that at the end of 83, and then after some appeals allowed it to continue until January of 85, except for, and then come a whole bunch of exceptions, people, for example, who move today. If a pastor in 1984 who owns his own home leaves and moves to St. Louis, he does not get that double tax deduction on his new property. He gets it only until he moves or until January 1. So I don't know. It's a complicated thing. But my understanding is that the other aspect of it, the treatment as a minister of the gospel, is operative now. That is, the synod in its convention this summer has reclassified its professional servants. That's officially involved as our position on the day it's adopted. Maybe we ought to put out something in the... Should I speak to the attorneys and have something put in the reporter? I really don't know. But if there's a question, I think I should make sure that somebody tells you. So let me do that. When I get back, I'll give the attorney a note and make sure that the Senate is fully informed on that. Yes, the man behind you.
How well is the new hymnal being accepted throughout the Senate? I'm asking because I know pastors usually are blamed, if that's the right word.
Yeah.
Is that something we're going to have to deal with when we get placed?
Yes. it's being well received. I don't know, Dr. Fremder was here a moment ago, and he's on the Commission on Worship, but he probably had to go to class or fix lunch for Ernestine or whatever he does about this time of day. But the hymnal has, I don't remember the last exact statistic. I know that at the convention they handed me a copy up there on the stage of volume number 700,000, And that doesn't mean that 700,000 have been sold, but the figure is very close to that. 690 or something have been sold and are in use in congregations of the Synod. It's estimated that at its height, the old TLH, Lutheran hymnal, had about 950,000 copies in circulation. So I think as a ballpark figure, we're at about two-thirds the distribution level of the previous hymnal. You do hear some grousing and grumbling about this and that in the new hymnal, and but not particularly strong. I don't perceive a lot of rumbles about it. Where there are rumbles, it tends to be because the congregation jumped in too fast, I think. You know, where the pastor decided, or the board of elders, that, you know, next Sunday we're going to start using it, and it was in the pews, and there was no, or at least an inadequate introduction to it. I think that just as a rule of thumb, support what I'm sure the profs are saying all the time. They've been saying as long as I've been around them, take it easy on liturgical change. Be very, very patient. Let them get used to a new hymn or a new setting or something before you expect them to like this thing overnight. The most gripes that I hear are because, well, some say it's too heavy. It's heavy. Or that you have to page around too much in it. And a lot of churches are going to these multicolored ribbons, and that is probably something we should have foreseen and didn't. But I don't know. I feel that most people that I'm rubbing shoulders with are saying that there's a little more sense of celebration and joy in the services in the new hymnal, and when people get used to it, they basically like it. I hope so. Carl, am I looking too much to my right? I know I have a tendency to do that. Yes. Would you speak, please?
There's been a lot of talk in the news lately about the quality of education, elementary and high school level. And I know that the Synod has always prided itself on our elementary and more high school education. But also in my limited experience, I know that there's some disenchantment on the part of teachers, and also some questions about the quality we are getting. Are there some concrete things that the Synod is doing to assure continued quality elementary and high school education, and also continued support, spiritual, financial, professional, for the teachers?
Well, it's a very good question. I think the question perhaps speaks to itself in a way, in a sense that it urges the necessity for working at quality and working for support of teachers and others engaged in education. First of all, the enrollment figures for both high schools and parish schools are much higher again this year. We're just about ready to pass the 200,000 mark on parish school enrollments, which would be the first time in the history of the Synod. So in terms of numbers, we have good acceptance. The quality question hasn't hit my desk very often. I must say I'm not aware of a quality control problem. But there are some efforts being taken. For example, this weekend, there is a meeting of all the Lutheran high school people in the Synod taking place here in St. Louis. Carl, you're keynoting in that, aren't you? And I know I'm over there too. Jim Bolt, the new staff man in this area, has just done a superb job in bringing the high school people together, and I know that one of the issues there is the maintenance of quality. So I must speak, unfortunately, in generalities, but as I know the staff, I know that there is a strong commitment to quality and to support. I think the Synod showed a level of support this summer with the actions it took on the classification of teachers. It's kind of low-keyed and laid back, but it's quite clear that women teachers are finally, at long last, regarded as teachers of the Synod. We've got a lot of work to do to pay them adequately and upgrade their status. And in general, the morale of teachers needs perhaps more attention than the morale of preachers that I talked about earlier. They have sensed that the CTCR document, I think incorrectly sensed, but nevertheless sensed that Synod is saying they're second-class citizens and that kind of thing. We need to work hard at this area, and we are aware of it, and I appreciate your calling it to my attention. Maybe I ought to move over this way. Yes, let's get this man.
What's the progress rate
I heard everything except the third word. What's the what?
The Lutheran College program.
Yeah, what are you asking about? What is its future? Oh, progress. Well, it's in some respects the... Do you know what he's talking about? There is an institute for Hispanic ministries on the campus of Concordia College River Forest with the specific goal of preparing Hispanic pastors for service in the Senate, and it enrolls primarily Hispanics who don't handle English very well. It's a the story of how it came to be is a very improbable one. It has taken all kinds of strange efforts to achieve even the little bit we have there, but we won't go into that. As far as I understand it, the situation, first of all, in the last year has been upgraded quite a bit. We have a full-time people there now. Dr. Sims has technically switched his institutional affiliation from River Forest to the Institute as a call of the Synod. And Juan Berndt, who served in Argentina and then in Texas for a number of years, is full-time faculty member. And we have some additional faculty people, and as I understand it, a fairly strong commitment to make this thing go. I know only from something I heard in passing that there are some questions being raised also with reference to this institution and its relationship to the Institute, but I don't know enough about that to comment. But whatever is going on in an effort to give some stability and strength and continuity to that institution. I personally am very much behind the Institute and the need to train not only Hispanics but many, many, many others in a way other than the traditional MDiv curriculum. I feel very strongly about it, and we'll be shortly putting some things together and asking the seminaries to carry the ball. Going to have to. The one frustration in this job, above all others, is the wanting to do something about something that needs doing and the inability to see it happen. I get so terribly frustrated. It used to be that, you know, when I teach a class, when I was finished, at least I had covered something I could look back on. And this position, I know of a need, but before the day is out, I found three others and haven't done anything about the first one. A couple weeks ago, walked into a room at the building headquarters to bring greetings to a group of people who are working among Southeast Asian immigrants, and made the mistake, I guess, in terms of my schedule, of saying, "Is there anything you want to tell me?" And an hour and a half later, I walked out of that room a changed man on that problem. What they're asking for is somebody to come and preach the gospel and administer the sacraments in Southeast Asian communities in this country, and the Missouri Synod has been unable to send them anybody. And if we're going to answer that kind of a call by saying, well, we have the MDiv program at Fort Wayne and at St. Louis, and we'll help you all we can, we can give you a little financial aid, and in 4 years, you know, you're going to... No, the need is now for Hispanic communities and for Southeast Asians and blacks and others. So we really have to get behind something like the Instituto de Luterano in River Forest. Yes?
I don't know if this question is too much different than one asked before, and so that you need not answer it. But I feel bad when I go in to visit a congregation and read that any and all Lutherans are allowed to take communion there. Wondering if I even feel right about taking communion there. And hearing from congregation members, one pastor comes in and says it's okay to be a lodge member, and another one comes in and says it's not. Without raising protests of wish hunts or Gestapo tactics or neo-Lutheranism, is there any hope for more conquering? I know it's being adopted in practice.
Yeah, it's a very good question. And the one thing I haven't really said at all today is probably the number one study project in the Missouri Synod at this time is the study of inter-Christian relationships done under the leadership of the CTCR. And we have called for a church-wide, ground zero, in-depth study of our relationships to other Lutherans. A part of the goal of that is to have some
guidance for the whole church that will enable us to do the same things, generally speaking, as we approach some of these problems. But the process itself is badly needed. We have to get people in the congregation you just described, with their admission to communion policies, understanding what the synod's policies and principles are, and walking together, doing things on the basis of the same principle. In other words, yes, something is being done in congregations like this, but what is being done is largely a process of study under the guidance of the CTCR and the district presidents that we hope will bring about a greater measure of consensus in the way we approach these questions.
I had heard something about a pastoral letter from the synodical president.
The dream, yes, we have lots of those. The plan is that, it's been a plan, however, for 2 years, so I say with a certain amount of reluctance. The plan is to begin a pastoral newsletter from my office to all the pastors about quarterly. Dr. Preuss, many years ago, had something that was called Brother to Brother. And before that, Dr. Harms had a pastoral newsletter called Memo to My Brethren. And we have hoped to do that kind of thing for some time. And recently I have said it's more than a hope, it's got to happen. And we do have some people working on letterhead design and logo design and that kind of thing. And we hope that by November, that sort of communication from my office to the pastors will be able to address questions like that. Thank you for reminding me of that. I haven't been over here to the... Hello, Martin. How in the world are you? Carl, is it time to eat lunch?
Well, it approaches that hour.
Well, we've got two more minutes. There's time for half a question.
There's one back there yet, and then we'll close it off.
Okay. Actually, it's two very great concerns. One can be handled quickly. We're just wondering, has the Purple Palace leak been fixed?
The Purple Palace leak?
Do you mean the one, the communications leak, or do you mean we have different kinds. So some leak water, some do not. Yes, I think so.
Okay, the other is, what can pastors, congregations, seminary students do as far as expressing dissension against having another or even repeated extraordinary financial appeal?
Actually, the Senate voted to do it by a vote of 465 to 355 or something like that. It was one of the closer votes at the convention, roughly a 4-3 thing. I think you should express, having said that Synod decided that it may happen no sooner than 1986, and predictably that's interpreted to mean in 1986, it has by no means been decided that it will be in 1986. I mean, I'm one who is dragging feet a little bit. I'm trying to do something about that 4-3 attitude in the Senate. I don't think it's going to go anywhere, if, for one thing, unless we have a little bit more of an understanding of why it might be necessary, what we could do with it, and I think the assurance that it will not impede or get in the way of sustained stewardship. You know, people who are giving proportionately are simply upset by the appeal to go beyond that. There's so much to be said about that. It's one of the few ways, however, that the... Think about this one, and I'm going to say it in double talk, I think. It's one of the few ways the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, as a national church body, has of reaching into the congregations of several districts of this church to tell them why we're a synod and what we're doing together, and involving them in the work of the synod. There are parts of the church where the national work of this synod simply doesn't get addressed at all. Another group of people who are reached by something like this are the very wealthy people who are not giving, I think wisely so, not giving $100,000 a year to the local parish. But they aren't being asked by the synod. You know, they're sending checks to Robert Schuller's program and that kind of thing. This kind of program also enables us to reach these very wealthy people with some requests for direct gifts to do some big things. And then the third observation. Almost anything this church body has done of any significance in the last 2 years by way of expansion has been done with monies contributed through Forward in Remembrance. Now think about that one. We're going over, the folks are coming, are going over to Korea at the end of this month, the 25th anniversary of that church, to dedicate a $500,000 seminary. Communicant membership of that church body is 1,600. It isn't as big as some of the parishes in the Missouri Synod. They're running a seminary, and they're doing it with what? With FIR monies. I'm not trying to say the end justifies the means or anything like that, but before we simply write off the extraordinary appeal approach, let's think about it. Maybe there's a way in which this can be done as a part of the church's way of approaching all of God's people to do the most we can to meet the needs of the world. But by all means, let your views be heard. There is a Council on Stewardship newly created that will be hearing and receiving these views and trying to move ahead responsibly.
Well, it's obvious, Mr. President, that with all the blessings God has given are also frustrations and obstacles, and if you ever want to come again to a completely trouble-free area of the church, why, we invite you to return.
Have you cleaned up all the problems left by the previous administration? I've always wanted to ask you that.
I was going to take a ballot on those three presidents that you mentioned before, but most of my friends left already. We're very grateful to you, and let's tell the president again how thankful we are for his presence.